The first poem in the imaginary book. If it were me, when the book arrives, I would immediately start scanning pages to find any trace of me. My name, references to my body, my secrets, moments we shared. I would pretend to be horrified if I found evidence of myself, but really, I would pray to find even a single mention. You may do nothing like that. You may not even crack the spine. You may place this on the bookshelf or worse, under a stack of papers. You may forget it and or gift it later to someone at Secret Santa. I will never know. But just in case you are like me, just in case you do still think about the way your hands used to piano key my spine, the way you would whisper spells into my ears when I was napping, the way I slipped notes into your jacket pockets, just in case you wonder if all those winks ever meant anything at all, I will tell you. You do not need to look very hard to find your shadow here. Your fingerprints are on these pages, so many of your footsteps in the snow. Love poem number 137. I will wake you up early even though I know you like to stay through the credits. I will leave pennies in your pockets, postage stamps of superheroes in between pages of your books, sugar packets on your kitchen counter. I will Hansel and Gretel you home. I talk through movies, even ones I have never seen before. I will love you with too many commas, but never any asterisks. There will be more sweat than you are used to, more skin, more words than are necessary. My hair in the shower drain, my smell on your sweaters, bobby pins all over the windowsills. I make the best sandwiches you have ever tasted, and you'll be in charge of the napkins. I can't do a pull-up, but I'm great at excuses. I count broken umbrellas after every thunderstorm, and I fall asleep repeating the words, thank you. I will wake you up early with my heavy heartbeat. You'll say, can't we just sleep in? And I'll say, no, trust me, you don't want to miss a thing. Mrs. Ribeiro. I was visiting a school in northern India when I heard it for the first time in ages. It was barely audible above the shouting of children, the squeals and laughter bubbling from the schoolyard through the classroom windows, but it was there. The swish of silk saris and the jingle-jangle of bangles on thin wrists like wind chimes. This is what learning sounds like, I remember. When I was 5 years old, the principal of my junior school was Mrs. Ribeiro. She was an Indian woman the size of a nightlight, and she glided like a sailboat through the hallways of my school. Once, when I got close enough to grab a fistful of her draping silk sari, I lifted it to try to see whether she had any feet at all. I thought she floated. We begged to be sent to her office. The hanging plants like a jungle above our heads, her quiet laughter. Adults needed appointments. But we didn't. And even when she was in a grown-up meeting, all it took was a gentle knock at the door, a peek around the corner, and she was off calling. Sorry, dear, we'll have to reschedule. I have to see someone about a very important matter. It's about a gold star. It's about a new diorama. It's about a finished reading book one level higher than the last time. She visited every classroom, knew every student by name. She spoke to us like we were scholars, artists, scientists, athletes, musicians, and we were. My world was the size of a crayon box, and it took every color to draw her. Once, on a New York City sidewalk, a group of women in brightly colored saris walked by, and someone shouted, "Look, Mom, look at all those principals." My world was the size of a classroom. It was as tall as I could stretch my fingers, calling, please, let me be the one to read to Mrs. Ribeiro. Let me be the one to show her what I know. Clothes, shirts, pants, socks, shoes. Animals, cat, dog, bird, fish. Look how much I know. She brought us guests, an artist, and a petting zoo. They set up the cages in the parking lot while we were still tucked in our classrooms unaware. Rabbits and guinea pigs poked out their noses, Mrs. Ribeiro came to rest in front of the llama cage. She and the llama considered each other for a long time. She asked if he was tame enough to go inside. The trainers laughed and told her he was plenty tame, but he didn't know how to go upstairs. So she led him to the elevator. And when the door slid open on the second floor, there stood Mrs. Ribeiro in her bright pink sari, with golden bangles and a llama on a leash. She floated from class to class, and we stared, cheered, laughed, and shouted. We tugged at her sari, calling, "Miss, what is that? Where did it come from?" She made us wonder. She made us question. She made us proud of what we had learned. Clothes, shirts, pants, shoes, socks, saris. Animals, cat, dog, bird, fish, llama. Look how much I have learned. She taught us to share. She taught us to listen when someone else is speaking. And then she let us go. We were dandelions released to the wind. She asked for no return. We are saplings now, with gentle hands. The girl with bright cheeks and messy hairpins works at an orphanage in Cameroon. The boy with the colored ordered markers is a graphic designer in Chicago. The girl with the best diorama is an animal activist in Argentina. And the girl who loves to read out loud is a poet in India. She let us fly. So, I find myself at the front of the classroom. My students tug at my sleeves and ask me, "Miss, do all poets have crazy hair and big black boots?" I cry for patience, for wisdom, to find a way to tame all the peculiar animals of this world, to coax them enough to brave the elevator, to see the doors slide open to my students' gaping mouths. All their wild wonder. They worry about everything. They worry about what to write. They worry about their grades. They worry about who likes whom. They talk over one another until I cannot hear them. So I tell them, listen. Listen to one another like you know you are scholars, artists, scientists, athletes, musicians, like you know you will be the ones to shape the world. Show me how many colors you know how to draw with. Show me how proud you are of what you have learned. And I promise I will do the same. My parents on their way home from a wedding. When they pick up the phone, all I can hear is Simon and Garfunkel blaring in the background. For a few seconds, it is only this. Wind static and the strum of guitars, simple harmonies of open windows and streaked sunlight. Then my father's barrel-based chocolate growl, my mother's piccolo breath. They are laughing through the speakerphone, telling me about the ceremony, how lovely it was. There are trees sliding into one another faster than they have time to count. So many flowers, they say. What a beautiful dress. I was calling to tell them about something sour, something less blossom and more thorn, that I inhale. Swallow. It can wait. They are laughing through the speakerphone. They are laughing, and they are driving on a highway they have not been on before. Mother says, "Oops, I think we might have gotten lost. We'll have to call you back." They forget that I'm on the line, point out street corners that are named the wrong names. Notice trees they could have sworn they passed sometime before. Dragons. My father and brother were born with cannonball fists and avalanche tongues. They know how to light flame to the smallest injustice, how to erupt into fireworks from the inside. The silent anger, too. They're capable of keeping the engine humming, deep vibration of fury warm underneath. Me, I was not born with enough fuel. My anger often melts into sadness. It will just disintegrate into shame or fear. My clenched teeth release into chatter. But you have found the right mix of arrogance and alcohol. Place your hands on me one more time, then again exhale the cigarette into my eyes. Tell me again how I'm just not understanding the point. Remind me how you are an expert. Touch my knee, my thigh, my lower back. ignore me twice, three times, continue talking over me with the man to my right. There is a beast in my veins that was birthed by my father. It is quiet. It sleeps through most nights. Tonight, sir, the tail twitches in the darkest caves. So be careful, darling. Your footsteps land heavy here. Your racket will wake the dragons. Hand-me-downs. You have taken to wearing around your father's hand-me-down anger. I wish that you wouldn't. It's a few sizes too big, and everyone can see it doesn't fit you. Hangs loose in all the wrong places, even if it does match your skin color. You think you'll grow into it, that your arms will beef up after all the fighting, and it will sit on your shoulders if only you pin it in the right places with well-placed conviction. The bathroom mirror tells you, you look good. Your fists look a lot more justified. When you dig your hands deep into the pockets, you'll find stories he left there for you to hand out to other boys like car bombs. On days where everything else is slipping through your fingers, you can wrap yourself inside of this anger. This will keep you warm at night, help you drift off to sleep, with the certainty that no matter what happens, it will still be there when you wake up. The longer you wear it, the better it fits, until some of the stories are your own. The holes in the sleeve are from bullets you've dodged yourself. When it rips, snags on a barbed wire fence or someone else's family, don't worry. Your mother and sister will mend it, patch the holes, sew the tears, replace a button or two. They will help you back into it and tell you how proud they are of you, how good it looks. The same way it looked on your dad and your granddad, and on his father before him and on his father before him. But back then there was only sand, until someone drew a line. Someone built a wall, someone threw a stone. And the crack in the skull that I hit fractured perfectly like twigs on the branches of a family tree, so someone threw a stone back, and on each fracture, each tiny break, wound itself together with thread. The thread pulled itself around him, your great, 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 great somebody, and on the other side of the wall, they were knitting just as fast, and theirs fit them just as well, only in slightly different shade. So I'm asking, when the time comes, who's going to be the first to put down the needle and the thread? Who is going to be the first to remember that their grandfather suffered just as many broken bones, broken hearts, broken windows? And the first time you come down to dinner and your son is sitting at the dining room table wearing your hatred on his shoulders, who is going to be the first to tell him it is finally time to take it off? The shirt. The night I slept over, you lent me your shirt. When I wore it out of the bathroom, you laughed and said, "Oh well, now it's yours." I did not understand what you meant, but you insisted I keep it. So the first couple of nights, I wore it like a puddle, splashed through it, trying to remember how the rain had felt. When that failed, I found a photograph of oranges and punched in the glass. I stretched your shirt across a wood frame, made it a canvas. I tried to paint swans, but I'm not a very good painter. They looked more like turtles on a bad hair day. The next night, I hung it on the flagpole and tried to signal the gods. I don't think the gods read flags. That would make sense. I made a hammock and tried to rest inside of it, but I may have stretched it out with all of my wriggling. I tossed in the laundry with the other clothes, and the colors ran. It looks different than it did before. Next time I saw you, I was embarrassed. I had tried to make it into something beautiful, and I had done my best to find something new to show you. You laughed again, your popcorn laugh, and said you didn't have to make it into anything. And I didn't understand, so you said, "Does it fit?" I said, "Yes." Then just wear it, silly. Grace. I woke up this morning and said thank you. To the ceilings, the bedsheets, the mirror, the windows, to whomever was listening. For the softly swaying hammock, the salt air, the clouds that roll in while I wasn't watching, the sounds of someone starting a fire nearby, the smell of a man's body, the sound of a sleepy baritone from within the chest I press my head against, the way his heart beat out of time with his quiet singing, and his breath came out of time with both. And for the damp grass below us, and the swinging door of the outdoor shower, for the goosebumps on his skin from the darkling evening, for his patient arms around me, and the weight of him against me, and for the softly swaying hammock, somehow large enough to carry all of this. Postcards. I had already fallen in love with far too many postage stamps, so when you appeared at my doorstep, you are nothing but a postcard promise. No, appear is the wrong word. Is there a word for sucker-punching someone in the heart? Is there a word for when you're sitting at the bottom of a roller coaster and you realize the climb is coming, you know what the climb means, you can already feel the flip in your stomach from the fall before you even moved? Is there a word for that? There should be. You can only fit so many words in a postcard. Only so many in a phone call, only so many into space before you forget that words are sometimes used for things other than filling emptiness. It is hard to build a body out of words. I have tried. We have both tried. Instead of laying your head on my chest, I tell you about the boy who lives downstairs, who stays up all night playing his drum set. The neighbors have complained, they have busy days tomorrow, but he keeps on thumping through the night. Convinced, I think, that practice makes perfect. Instead of holding my hand, you tell me about the sandwich you made for lunch, the way the pickles fit so perfectly against the lettuce. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Repeat the same mistakes over and over, and you don't get any closer to Carnegie Hall. Even I know that. Repeat the same mistakes over and over, and you don't get any closer. You never get any closer. Is there a word for the moment you win tug of war? When the weight gives and all that extra rope comes hurtling towards you? How even though you've won, you still end up with muddy knees and burns on your hands? Is there a word for that? I wish there was. I would have said it when we were finally alone together on your couch, neither of us with anything left to say. Still now, I send letters into space, hoping that some mailman somewhere will recognize you from the descriptions in my poems and track you down. He will place the stack of them in your hands and tell you, there is a girl who still writes to you. She doesn't know how not to. Loose threads. The buttons on the sleeve of your jacket were cracked in two. Both of them, on your right arm, were missing their other halves and existed in forlorn semicircles, 180 degrees of imperfection. Brown buttons, still clinging by a thread to your jacket material despite their lack of wholeness, despite their missing appendages. I wondered if you knew that part of you was missing. I wondered where the other halves had gone. If they weren't together somewhere, lying on a dresser, two halves that didn't fit together because they belong to two different buttons. Or if you had lost them both independently, one getting stuck on the turnstile of the subway, the other falling off somewhere down a crowded hallway. We ate sushi and talked about college and work and basketball and didn't talk about love and sex and loneliness and friendship and buttons half missing. I wondered if years from now, you would remember where it was you lost me. B. Instead of Mom, she's going to call me Point B. Because that way she knows that no matter what happens, at least she can always find a way back to me. And I'm going to paint the solar systems on the back of her hands, and she has to learn the entire universe before she can say, oh, I know that like the back of my hand. And she's going to learn that this life will hit you hard, in the face, wait for you to get back up just so it can kick you in the stomach. but getting the wind knocked out of you is the only way to remind your lungs how much they like the taste of air. There is hurt here. It cannot be fixed by band-aids or poetry. So the first time she realizes that Wonder Woman isn't coming, I'll make sure she knows she doesn't have to wear the cape all by herself. Because no matter how wide you stretch your fingers, your hands will always be too small to catch all the pain you want to heal. Believe me, I've tried. And baby, I'll tell her, don't keep your nose up in the air like that. I know that trick. I've done it a million times. You're just smelling for smoke so you can follow the trail back to a burning house, so you can find the boy who lost everything to fire to see if you can heal him. Or better yet, find the boy who lit the fire in the first place to see if you can change him. But I know she will anyway, so instead, I'll always keep an extra supply of chocolate and rain boots nearby, because there is no heartbreak that chocolate cannot fix. Okay, there are a few heartbreaks that chocolate cannot fix, but that's what the rain boots are for, because the rain will wash away everything if you let it. I wanted to look at the world through the underside of a glass-bottomed boat, to look through a microscope at the galaxies that exist on the pinpoint of a human mind, because that's the way my mom taught me. That there'll be days like this, that there'll be days like this, my mama said, when you open your hands to catch and wind up with only blisters and bruises. When you step out the phone booth and try to fly, and the very people you want to save are the ones standing on your cape. When your boots will fill with rain, and you'll be up to your knees in disappointment. And those are the very days where you have all the more reason to say thank you, because there is nothing more beautiful than the way the ocean refuses to stop kissing the shoreline, no matter how many times it's swept away. You will put the wind in winsome, lose some. You'll put the star in starting over and over, and no matter how many landmines erupt in a minute, be sure your mind lands on the beauty of this funny place called life. And yeah, on a scale from 1 to over trusting, I am pretty damn naive. I want her to know that this world is made out of sugar. It can crumble so easily, and don't be afraid to stick out your tongue and taste it. Baby, I'll tell her, remember, your mama is a worrier, and your papa is a warrior, and you're the girl with small hands and big eyes who never stops asking for more. Remember that good things come in threes, and so do the bad things. And always apologize when you've done something wrong, but don't you ever apologize for the way your eyes refuse to stop shining. Your voice is small, but don't you ever stop singing. And when they finally hand you heartache, when they slip war and hatred under your door and offer you handouts on street corners of cynicism and defeat, you tell them they really ought to meet your mother. And found. I am a god of drawers left unopened. It is easy to catch me in the act of searching. My keys, myself. Careful, don't sit there. You might knock over the pile of confidence I took all day to stack. I promise to tidy up before company arrives. Wouldn't want my socks and daydreams all over the carpet. Sure, I know where most things are, but give me enough time and I can lose anything. I've had enough practice at sliding things under the bed when no one is watching. And I know you are always in the last place I look. On being prepared. 1. Now. Sometimes when I am by myself, I imagine my own murder. Open window, the 3 steps necessary to cross the room, blunt object to the skull, red ribbon, and the feel of the carpet against my cheek. I fix my hair in the mirror, change a song to one with cello. When they find me, someone will check the time of death. Someone will do the math, count backwards to the music, press the buttons, back, back, back. They will find out which song was playing when it happened. Even when no one is home, I am careful what I listen to. 2. Then. I used to practice what I would look like when someone was falling in love with me. I'd tilted my head, looked into the distance. I don't even notice you falling in love with me, I practiced to the mirror. I'm too preoccupied with what I'm doing. Nobody wants me knows when they are falling in love. It's a private moment. Whoever was falling in love with me, I reasoned, deserved not to be disturbed. 3. Sometime. I'm working in my pajamas. There is a knock at the door. Teeth unbrushed, hair unwashed. I leave everything to answer. You kiss me and take off your coat. Don't have long to spare, you say. Just came by to say hello. In the other room, my music skips. The carpet squishes between my toes. I wasn't expecting you. On the discomfort of being in the same room you like, in the same room as the boy you like. Everyone is looking at you, looking at him. Everyone can tell. He can tell. So you spend most of your time not looking at him. The wallpaper, the floor, there are cracks in the ceiling. Someone has left a can of iced tea in the corner. It is half empty. I mean, half full. There are 4 light bulbs in the standing lamp. There is a fan. You are counting things to keep from looking at him. 5 chairs, 2 laptops, someone's umbrella, a hat. People are talking, so you look at their faces. This is a good trick. They will think you're listening to them and not thinking about him. And now he is talking, so you look away. The cracks in the ceiling are in the shape of a whale, or maybe an elephant with a fat trunk. If he ever falls in love with you, you will lie on your backs in a field somewhere and look up at the sky, and he'll say, "Baby, look at that silly cloud. It's a whale." And you'll say, "Baby, that's an elephant with, you know, a fat trunk." And you'll argue for a bit, but he will love you anyway. He is asking a question now, and no one has answered yet. So you lower your eyes from the plaster and say, "The 21st, I think." He smiles and says, "Oh, cool." And you smile back, and you cannot stop your smiling. Oh, you cannot stop your smile. The paradox. When I am inside writing, all I can think about is how I should be outside living. When I am outside living, all I can do is notice all there is to write about. When I read about love, I think I should be out loving. When I love, I think I need to read more. I am stumbling in pursuit of grace. I hunt patience with a vengeance. On the mornings when my brother's tired muscles held on to the pillow, my father used to tell him, "For every moment you aren't playing basketball, someone else is on the court practicing." I spend most of my time wondering if I should be somewhere else. So I have learned to shape the words "thank you" with my first breath each morning, my last breath every night. When the last breath comes, at least I will know I was thankful for all the places I was so sure I was not supposed to be. All those places I made it to, all the loves I held, all the words I wrote. And even if it is just for one moment, I will know exactly where I'm supposed to be.